Johnnies. It's Thursday, the 15th of September, and this is Game On. Coming up today, another week and another goat is going from the world of tennis. This time, it's Roger Federer.
I am 41 years old. I've played more than 1,500 matches over 24 years. Tennis has treated me more generously than I ever would have dreamt, and now I must recognize when it is time to end my competitive career. The Laver Cup next week in London will be my final ATP event. I will play more tennis in the future, of course, but just not in Grand Slams or on the tour.
More on that with superfan Stephen Higgins very shortly. In rugby, Bernard Jackman is in studio to look ahead to the URC and look back on today's epic finish in Melbourne.
You want it, Maona, Jordan, Crossfield, Jordan, around the Barrett Royal Box. Robbie's heart broken.
There's European club action in football with Shamrock Rovers already underway, as are Manchester United. Vinnie Perth is in studio to cover that, and Stephen Kenny's squad naming today. Plus, in our Eye on America, Jeff Shepherd reviews week one of the NFL season. If you want to get in touch, please text us on 51552 or tweet at GameOn2FM.
Game On on 2FM.
So Manchester United are leading Sheriff by 1-0, a goal just now from Jadon Sancho. Unfortunately for Shamrock Rovers, they are trailing Ghent by 2 goals with just 18 minutes played there. Vinnie Perth is with me in studio. Vinnie, not the start they wanted at all.
No, Shamrock Rovers started quite well in terms of possession. They were in the tie, but unfortunately at this level you get really punished for mistakes. And while the first goal is a decent goal from Ghent, the second goal is just, it's criminal for Shamrock Rovers. It's from their own goal kick. Dan Cleary cuts inside, slips, falls over, and Ghent punished them, and it's 2-0 down. And you just don't get away with that at this level. And it's going to be a difficult night for them now. They just need to stay in the game now as long as they can.
Yeah, stay in the game. We've said that a few times for Shamrock Rovers, and unfortunately it hasn't been the case, Vinnie, when they've conceded goals late on. How difficult is it going to be for them now?
Yeah, no, Ghent are a top side, and it's a really difficult opposition for Shamrock Rovers. They would have liked and be competitive tonight, and I think it's just, you just can't give away goals at this level. We've seen it. This really goes against you as an Irish side. You need to ride your luck a little bit against top opposition in Europe, and you can't have moments like this. So the 2 goals, Stephen Bradley will say after the game, were completely avoidable, and they were just wasn't good defending. So look, Dan Cleary's been a brilliant signer for them in terms of the club, but they've lost Pico Lopez through injury and people like that. That's a big blow at this level. The strength and depth in your squad is crucial, and ultimately they've been punished so far tonight.
Yeah, it's hard. It was a hard watch, actually, particularly that second goal and seeing a mistake like that. How does that happen, Vinny? You know, when you're in a game and it's like, it's high pressure, high intensity, and you'd think that you know the players would be even more tuned in.
Yeah, I suppose, look, we've seen Dan Cleary slip last week in the first European game and getting away with one, and you'd like to think players learn from that, but it's from their own kickoff, tip off should I say, inside the box. And this modern way of playing out from the back where the keeper rolls at 3 yards, and it's so easy for the opposition to press, and I'm sort of against it myself. And you see an example why it doesn't work. It was so easy for Ghent to have 3 players around Dan Cleary once he slipped. And look, people slip, it's part of, you know, happens, and just at the highest level to get punished. And another day it actually deflected off Dan Cleary's head, another day goes over the bar, but not tonight. They're 2-0 down, and they're the ones that will hurt you as a coach. You don't mind the team out playing you and being really good, but both goals are completely avoidable tonight, and as I keep saying, this could be a difficult night for them.
Yeah, frustration, I'd say, is going to be the feeling of Stephen Bradley at halftime, and probably at the end of the game now, I'd say, at this stage too, because 2-0 down, 21 minutes played, doesn't look like they're going to be able to get away back into this against a team of the quality of Ghent. Right, stay with us because Vinnie will be giving us updates on this game throughout the hour, and we will also be looking at the other European football, and of course as well the announcement of Stephen Kenny's squad a little bit earlier today. For now, though, we are going to turn our attention to Roger Federer, who has announced his retirement today. Well, he's imminent retirement. Stephen Higgins of Cross Gorfu is with me in studio. It's quite interesting being across from you, Stephen. I know you're a tennis super fan. It's probably a good way to describe you, all right. And when somebody like Roger Federer retires at his age and given all he's achieved, I thought it'd be a celebration, but you're really disappointed.
I'm holding it together. Yeah, I mean, it's a story for me, I suppose it goes back to like 21 years, 2001. It's probably the first time seeing him before Wimbledon. His kind of breakthrough amongst the general public would be when he beat Sampras, the defending champion at Wimbledon, and really announced himself as this force. It's a very summer day. If you look at across Twitter, the reaction from Carlos Alcaraz, the new world number one, who he was an idol to him. He never gets to play him now in the professional tour just by how their careers have developed. From Martina Vratilova, Billie Jean King, Rod Laver. It's all sadness. Petra Kvitova just goes on because he's such an extraordinary figure in terms of his achievements on the court, of course, but the way he handled himself, he's a style icon, the way he made tennis an important sport, probably, or more important sport than it was coming into his generation. And then obviously, because of his success, because of his ability, unfortunately for him, he led to the rise of people like Rafael Nadal and Novak Djokovic, who had to get that good to compete with him. But yeah, it's a sad, somber day for the sport.
What a career, though. And you outlined some of it in just there, but just the stats that are doing the rounds now: 310 weeks at number one, 20 majors, 28 masters, 1,000 titles, 6 ATP finals wins, almost 131 million in prize money. He's just, the longevity of his career is phenomenal.
Yeah, I think there's a million stats and people are still just processing this all today. And you're talking about a guy who's been on the tour for over two decades, and just like Serena Williams, it would take so long to go through all their achievements. But I think there's just a couple of, just in terms of longevity, beyond those headline figures of, say, at one point he made 10 major finals in a row. That's a record he holds. He made 23 major semi-finals in a row. And I think it's incredible. He made 36 consecutive quarterfinals in Grand Slams. That's 9 years straight of making at least the quarterfinals. Obviously, he won some of those tournaments as well. Some people, you know, most people never get even to play a Grand Slam, let alone get through the second week. And he's making 9 years of quarterfinals. His ability to retain his fitness through the vast majority of his career, it's only in recent years that they've started to have ailments like his knee issue, some back issues, etc. And then just the, you know, the crunch time to come up with his extraordinary ability to harness it in a way that would get him through to the second week of Grand Slams and compete. Sometimes when he was the youngest guy playing against the likes of the older generation, Sampras and Agassi, and then playing with the younger generation like Felix Auger-Aliassime and people who are almost half his age, the longevity is unbelievable.
Another thing he did as well, which is quite remarkable, and more often than not, people who are dominant enough or are quite dominant in their sport or at the top of their game for a long time or have that kind of ruthless winning streak, they're not liked, but people really liked him.
More than that, he's adored.
Okay, some people absolutely loved him. One of them is standing across from me, but most people liked him.
I mean, you're questioning my journalistic credentials here, but yeah, I mean, there was the famous t-shirt of Quiet Genius at Work with Federer. I mean, the style transcends the sport, really. I think even for people who had no appreciation of tennis or never played tennis, the way he played tennis, with the elegance, with the movement, his feet never made a sound really on courts. He's the perfect tennis player for the modern generation. The combination of his footwork, one of the best forehands we've ever seen, one of the best serves of all time. He's the third most aces in history. His magnificent touch around the net, his intelligence, his slice, his ability to adapt to different situations, apart from maybe playing Rafael Nadal at Roland Garros, but there's no shame in that. Yeah, the sport hadn't seen anyone really like him in the modern era. And you have to remember as well, when he came into tennis, Pete Sampras had the all-time Grand Slam record with 14. And then it wasn't long before he hit 20. And then you obviously have Rafael Nadal in 22 and Novak Djokovic in 21. So he really was the start of a new era of tennis. He was the leader of that.
Okay, well, let's hear from him.
I consider myself one of the most fortunate people on earth. I was given a special talent to play tennis, and I did it at a level that I never imagined for much longer than I ever thought possible. I would like to especially thank my amazing wife, Mirka, who has lived through every minute with me. She has warmed me up before finals, watched countless matches, even while over 8 months pregnant, and has endured my goofy side on the road with my team for over 20 years. I also want to thank my four wonderful children for supporting me, always eager to explore new places and creating wonderful memories along the way. Seeing my family cheering me on from the stands is a feeling I will cherish forever. I would also like to thank and recognize my loving parents, my dear sister, without whom nothing would be possible. I would also like to thank my competitors on the court. I was lucky enough to play so many epic matches that I will never forget. We pushed each other, and together we took tennis to new levels. Above all, I must offer a special thank you to my unbelievable fans. You will never know how much strength and belief you have given me. The inspiring feeling of walking into full stadiums and arenas has been one of the huge thrills in my life. I've had the immense fortune to play in front of you in over 40 different countries. I have laughed and cried, felt joy and pain, and most of all, I have felt incredibly alive. So I want to thank you all from the bottom of my heart to everyone around the world who has helped make the dreams of a young Swiss ball kid come true. Finally, to the game of tennis, I love you and will never leave you.
Wow, he sounds really genuine as well for everything, like for everybody he was thanking.
I think there's a really important aspect of his career along with Rafael Nadal. There's sportsmanship. There was one time, I think, at Indian Wells or Miami where Roger Federer threw his racket on the court and, you know, the earth stopped moving. It was like, oh my God, Roger Federer was angry with something threw. It just showed how the way he and Nadal can carry themselves with dignity. They're not berating umpires. They're not throwing rackets mm-hmm. around. They're not hurling abuse at opponents. Obviously, to some people, it depends who you talk to, whether that adds energy or not, or you know, some sort of attraction to the sport. But I think for young players coming through and for the rest of the tour, it set a brilliant example, maybe an impossible example, mm-hmm. but you can play and be extremely successful and show some humility and do it in style as well. These two guys, and Roger in particular, achieve that.
So what you're saying is he's perfect.
Well, this was always the thing. Well, he was perfect up to a degree. But I think as people talk about the statistics and they flow off the tongue, it's really his impact on tennis and the way that they could, say, take charitable matches down to South Africa and sell out to tens of thousands. He has done amazing work with his own foundation. His imprint goes beyond kind of almost the sport. He has transcended it in a way that, say, Tiger Woods has, maybe in a way that Lionel Messi might when he mm-hmm. retires as well. And doing it in not kind of based on sound bites or outbursts or controversy and that thing. It's all based on achievement on the court, stylishness, doing good things, you know, giving back to the sport as well, giving back to others in terms of the charitable contributions. So, yeah, in a word, it's fairly perfect. It'd be hard to match his legacy.
And you're going to be there when it all ends.
Yeah, so I thought with his knee surgery, so the last time he played was Wimbledon 2021. Unfortunately, he lost his last set 6-love to Hubert Erkacz. He's had three knee surgeries in the time since. He's obviously 41. There was always going to be this issue of would he come back at all. He had planned to come back at the Laver Cup, which is the tournament he's co-created, and he plays the Basel Open. That's his hometown tournament. He's won it 10 times. He always plays it. So I thought he might... If things went awry, he'd probably retire at one of those two. So yeah, I'll be going to Basel later. Unfortunately, he won't be playing that. But on behalf of RTE, I'll be at the Laver Cup next week, where he'll be joined by Rafael Nadal, Novak Djokovic and Andy Murray. The only time in the history of the sport, and now sadly the only time it will ever happen, where the four of them will play together on one team.
Oh, that's cool, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, the original idea behind the Laver Cup was to have a Ryder Cup style of tournament. And Europe has obviously been blessed with this generation of extraordinary talents. At different times, you've had Federer play with Nadal, Federer play with Djokovic and various combinations. But this is the first and only time that you'll actually have the four guys, in fairness to Andy Murray, who's had an extraordinary career, the four guys who've defined the last 25 years on the men's tour.
Now, I always love speaking to fans, like genuine fans, people, you know, a lot of time with sports like tennis, people drift in and drift out of it and they're there for the majors. But you were actually, now you're a journalist as well, but you're a huge fan of tennis. And the fact that you went in 2007 on your J1 to see him play in the US Open, and now fast forward however many of years and you're heading over as a journalist to cover his last tournament. That's pretty cool too.
Yeah, my dream when I was in journalism college all those years ago at Griffith was to interview Roger Federer, to ask him a question as a journalist. On my J1, I was there in New York, and I went into the US Open in baking, sweltering conditions. He was playing back-to-back with Justine Henin, who was the number one at the time on the women's side. She was also a wonderful player. And I remember, I didn't know this USTA, that there was loads of vacant seats in the lower tier, and I wandered down to get a closer look at Roger. And I remember sitting there, and a ticket umpire came along to see if you had the right tickets. And I was sitting in beside a family, and they thought it was part of that family kind of thing. It's like, oh, I'm sorry. And I ran back up again afterwards. But to finally see him in person, and you didn't hear it. And I always remember he played a college player called Scoville Jenkins, the poor guy. And this was Federer in his pomp, 2007, when he was just unbeatable. And he was obviously throwing the poor kid around. And these, like, the intellectuals from behind giving out about the attitude of the young American player. And I always remember, suck it up, Scoville, suck it up. It's like, he's literally playing the best player in the world and one of the greatest players of all time. But yes, going back to then, and then I saw him in 2019 at Wimbledon, which is probably the last time he made the final there, that he was the Federer that we recognised before injuries kind of took hold and curtailed his career as they did Serena.
Right, well, you better take a call from us now over there and let us know how it's all going.
I'd be delighted to.
Right. Well, Stephen, I'm sure you're probably going to go home now, sit there on YouTube and watch all his greatest moments. Actually, what was his greatest moment in your eyes?
I think the best contest and match is the Nadal, the match against Nadal at the Australian Open 2017, the final. Some of the rallies, the sentiment, where they were at their stage of their career is fantastic. Yeah, I'd appeal to anyone, watch that back, watch the highlights or the match if you can. Just magnificent, the peak of the sport.
Okay, well, we might tweet that out a little bit later on. Stephen Higgins of Cross Court View, thank you so much for joining us. We're going to take a very quick break and then we'll have an update from Vinnie Perth on the Shamrock Rovers Ghent match, and we'll be talking about the URC with Bernard Jackman.
Game on 2FM.
Yeah, welcome back. There are 35 minutes played in the Shamrock Rovers Ghent game and Shamrock Rovers are still trailing 2-0. Vinnie Perth has been watching it for us. Vinnie, have they got into the game any bit?
Yeah, they've settled down a little bit, and the only issue they have really is that when the ball turns over, Ghent have looked like it's 3v3. Ghent are playing similar system to Shamrock Rovers. The only difference is they play with two up front and they've ended up in a couple of 3v3 situations. And as I said, Shamrock Rovers injuries hurting them a little bit tonight. They've no Sean Hoare or Pico Lopez, so it's been a difficult night for them. Worked a really good corner there, Jack Byrne and Dylan Watts. Brilliant play from the two of them, worked a good corner, great ball into the box, and just unlucky defender really done well to clear the ball. So look, they've settled. That's all they can ask for. The manager will hope it's minimum 2-0 at half time and he'll sit them down and just try and clear some heads.
Okay, well, I'm sure you'll have a plan anyway. Bernard Jackman is with me in studio as well. Bernard, it feels like now we're in rugby season, and probably today, I think, really set that off. Anyone that was working from home today was probably working and sitting down watching Australia and New Zealand a little bit earlier on, and what a game it was. Lots of controversy, well, towards the end anyway, Bernard. I think there was a lot of confusion about what was going on. So for anyone that didn't see it, New Zealand got a last gasp victory over Australia. Geordie Barrett had an injury time try, but it was what happened before that try, really, Bernard, that had people wondering about laws and how he was able to get that try. I'll let you pick it up from here.
Yeah, so it was a phenomenal match, 37-39, so high scoring, back and forth, some brilliant rugby played by both teams, but Australia looked like they'd actually snatched the win. They won a penalty under their own post with just over 90 seconds left, and Bernard Foley, who's the very experienced Australian out half, really started to take the mick in terms of time wasting. Now there was a little injury and the referee had stopped the clock, but the French referee Mathieu Reynal said to him, clock's back on, and he really tried to draw it out, and I was obviously trying to get the clock to run down. Now they had a line out, if they had kicked the ball out they would have had a line out, and they could have wasted time going to the line out and then they just needed to win possession. But I've looked back on it and his own players are actually screaming at him to kick it, and in fairness the referee was strong, and there is so much time wasting that drives us mad, and sometimes referees pick up on it, but it's very rare to see it being picked up in a decisive moment like that, which effectively by giving New Zealand a scrum, a free kick, and then obviously they took a scrum, it was giving them one last chance to win, and they took that chance and they scored in the 82nd minute, and then to make level, and then they kicked the conversion from the touchline. So it was phenomenal. I think, look, as long as it's consistent it'll actually stop a lot of time wasting, but how many referees have the strength of character to do that? And it's typical French. I mean, I spent 5 years in the top 14. I know Mathieu Reynal well, but they can make big decisions at big times that don't necessarily happen, you know, week to week, but they are quite strong in terms of their personalities. And he, I think technically he was right. Bernard Foley was trying to wind down the clock too much.
Okay, so that's quite an interesting take on technically he was right. But do you think should he have done it? Like, do you think...
The referee?
Yeah.
Well, I think the fact when you see his own players screaming at him to kick it out that he has... Yeah. He'd overstepped that mark. You know, players will take... every advantage they can, but I think that he went too far, to be honest, and that's why the referee blew it up. Like, it's a big call for him.
Yeah, it was huge.
And for Dave Rennie, he'll be absolutely gutted. For Joe Schmidt, obviously, now, you know, back in New Zealand, that's a big win away from home. But yeah, it was a huge moment, and look, I can see why people will be saying it's the referee's fault, but in this occasion I do think Bernard Foley spent far too long and deserved to get picked up on it.
Now, I know the World Cup is still a bit away, but it feels like everything that we're going to be talking about for the next few months is going to have that shadow looming over when decisions are made, and we're looking at people's form in games, and you know, who's getting starts and who isn't getting starts. Should we be reading into anything from this game, do you think?
Yeah, I think the All Blacks are starting to show signs of improvement. I mean, their confidence was rock bottom, obviously having lost to Ireland in the series, and obviously having lost to France and Ireland in their previous games in November. And, you know, they've showed a little bit more today. I think Smith coming in there, the changes they made, they changed their forwards coach during the summer, and Foster now looks like he's going to survive. So I think that'll give them a little bit of clarity. They have phenomenal rugby players. I just think it's so open. I mean, you know, you're seeing Argentina being able to beat Australia, being able to beat New Zealand, South Africa, when they want to play and bring a lot of emotion, are next to unbeatable. And the two teams today are certainly looking dangerous. So yeah, it's probably the most open World Cup we've ever had. Mm-hmm. A year out.
Okay, it's a good place to be for sure. You hit the headlines yesterday, Bernard. You reckon that the emerging Ireland tour of South Africa is a terrible idea?
I do, and I'll tell you why. It's in the middle of a key part of the season when provinces are trying to find their best 15, trying to blood players, trying to get ready for winning URC points, which has now become more competitive than ever. So with the South African teams coming in, and I just think that it's the quality of opposition that they're going to play against in South Africa, which is really not a test, you know. So obviously they've gone a bit younger, I think, than they initially expected to do. I think there's been a big standoff between the provincial coaches and the RFU on this, because, like, if you take Leinster, for example, who had 21 players in New Zealand over the summer. So those players are only starting to up their pre-season now, because they've had their holiday after, etc. So they're not going to come back in till around 2, 3, 4. And it's at that stage that the Leinster blood those second choice players. And so guys like, you know, Joe McCarthy would have been playing for Leinster probably in at the same time this tour is on. And I think, you know, an URC game for your province where you're surrounded by players of a high level, where you know the game plan, is a better test than going to play some second and third rate opposition in South Africa. So I know it's focused on the World Cup and give them more depth, but we had 40 odd players in New Zealand. You know, there's only going to be 32 going to the World Cup. We played New Zealand Maoris twice. There's a game in November against New Zealand A in the RDS. Realistically, you know, bar the out half situation with obviously Kieran Frawley potentially being the backup to Joey Carby, who's the backup to Johnny Sexton, there's not many guys on this group who will make it. There's hardly any, you know. So I think this tour in the summer would have been perfect. But it's there now, and I suppose the provincial coaches have to deal with it. But they're all losing players who would have got an opportunity to play for them in that period that this tour is on.
What about what Simon Easterby said, though? You know, he puts a lot of value and stock into being away in that environment and getting used to that. And sometimes when they've had reviews of World Cups and things that have failed, the environment hasn't been right. So clearly it's something that they're trying to get right, and trying to get right for everybody.
Yeah, no, I don't think there's anything wrong with touring. But you tour, you tour somewhere at the right time, and you tour somewhere where you can actually judge the performance of players against proper opposition. Like, these opposition are not they're not strong, you know. There's going to be no one there. Like, for example, if, you know, if these guys were to play against the Bull Sharks or Stormers for their province, that's a proper test. That's a proper opportunity to judge them. If they were going to New Zealand to play ITM Cup teams, I would say, yeah, you know, that's a genuine challenge. But unfortunately, it's the opposition and the timing for me. Don't, and Simon has to say the party line. You know what I mean? It makes sense for him. But I think there's a lot of people in Irish rugby working in the provinces who think this is a bit of a joke, and they know more than I do, and they're just not allowed to say it.
Okay, well, let's have a look at some of those provinces. Who's going to lose out most?
Leinster are going to lose out most, but they have a big squad. But the problem is it's double whammy for them, because they also have the likes of Johnny Sexton, Tadhg Furlong, you know, Gary Ringrose, who are key players for Ireland. So their game time over this year is going to be micromanaged more than ever, which is rightly so. There's no issue with that. So now, in fairness, I think that Leinster, you know, Joe McCarthy and Kieran Frawley are the only two guys who are starting to get regular game time. So it is more the fringe players, you know, like Scott Penny, Alex Soroka, Max Deegan, who aren't maybe first choice for them, but they are players who are key players for them on a, you know, on a week where their internationals don't play. I think the interesting one is probably someone like Roman Salanoa, the tight head, who was in Leinster, has gone out to Munster, has been very unlucky with injury.
He's there a while now, though.
Yeah, he's been incredibly unlucky with injury. He's only played a very small amount of minutes, but he is very powerful and athletic. So he's interesting. You know, Jamie Osborne, Shea Mullins is a player who played for Bristol last year, was on the Ireland Sevens, got a third place medal. Very quick, I suppose, you're going to Connacht. You know, Ballacloon is an excellent player. Like, there's some good quality in here. It's just the problem is 12 months out from a World Cup, are they going to be able to do enough to force their way in? Because for them to get into the Irish squad, they're probably only going to have to be first choice of the provinces, and they're actually going to lose an opportunity to become first choice of the provinces by being away at this time. So that's the problem. So they might do brilliant on tour, but the players that have had those games that they missed are going to be further up ahead in the pecking order. That's the problem.
Maybe Andy Farrell's looking for a wild card or somebody. Look, we'll find. Time will tell for sure. So let's start with Leinster, because you did mention them there and their hopes for the season. So we know for a change they're coming in without a trophy, or they're not trying to defend any trophy. Do you think they're going to be motivated by that?
Yeah, for sure. There'll be a hangover there the whole summer. Look, they've been disappointed the last couple of seasons by just having a Pro 14 or a title. Obviously it's URC now. You know, Europe is where they judge themselves. They haven't been able to get the job done. But certainly to go in to a summer with no trophy and then see so many Leinster players beat the All Blacks, you know, it'll be a somber enough pre-season for them. There's some changes, obviously. You know, Sean O'Brien's coming in to replace Dennis Leamy. Andrew Goodman's coming in to replace Philippe Contaponi. Declan Darcy from the Dubs is coming in as a performance coach.
That's interesting, Bernard, I think, because it's rare enough that you see the crossover in sports. Now, it does happen. I know Lisa Fallon went in with the Dubs. Vinino were obviously quite well from football, and they won an All-Ireland when she was in there. But it doesn't happen too often.
No, like, and I think it's testament to the GAA that a pro game like rugby is starting to look at.
It does with the SNC. You know, we'd see that quite a bit.
Well, Limerick's SNC coach went to Ulster. Yeah. Caroline Curd.
Yeah.
Did, you know, I was doing Munster. But I think that's the level of the top teams in Gaelic football or hurling now, where the support staff have a huge amount of expertise. And I don't think it's any issue, especially if it's not a coaching role, is to bring in somebody who's been in an organisation who have got the job done. Like, let's be honest, the Dubs were very good at getting over the line. Leinster are brilliant all season, play some phenomenal rugby, are very hard to beat, but just unfortunately they haven't been able to, I suppose, bring Europe home since 2018. So
small margins.
The tiny margins, yeah, exactly. And it's fascinating. I think I admire Cullen and Lancaster for doing it. It'd be easier bring someone from rugby in. But why not? And I've got to know Declan Darcy a little bit over the last couple of years. Very interesting guy, very passionate, understands high performance. So yeah, it'll be Gary Keegan, obviously, has done a great job with Ireland. But yeah, there's an unbelievable amount of quality there. They're doing a huge amount right. They just need to get over that line.
But it's probably more common, Marie, than you think. And it's I know this is a really high profile one, and obviously Leinster would be a huge name in sport in this country. But the amount of shared knowledge that goes on, like I've spent time in Leinster, and they're so open in there in terms of Stuart Lancaster and Leo Cullen, really open, really welcome them to you. But vice versa, I've spent time in Jason Sherlock's company and Jim Gavin I would have spoken to. And it's so common that at the highest level, whether it's even a League of Ireland club, whether it's Leinster, you're just looking for that tiny margin that somebody might have found somewhere on a training ground or something they've said to players. And it's actually so common in all sports, because we're such a small country, you generally know somebody who knows somebody, and it is much more common. I think this one is really high profile, obviously.
Yeah,
and it's captured imagination.
No, absolutely, Vinny. And it mightn't be, it might be on the pitch, it might be in terms of the weekly planning, it might be, you know, in terms of a rehab, you know, process, or, you know,
just having a chat with somebody, a mindset.
Yeah, 100%. A mindset thing, giving someone confidence, looking up body language. I think Leo said something about body language, wasn't it? Or that he was the opposite, to look at body language, because the coaches are so into the actual efficiency of the session, that part of his job is looking at body language of players. Are they engaged? Like, I know some teams, like, they put a GoPro, which is these little cameras, on the water boy, you know, so when there's a huddle, the water boy runs in, he's given the water, and later on they look at the footage to see who's engaged, what's being said, you know, to try and improve that. I'm not, so there's lots of little things that we can, that are, people are trying to get that edge. And I think the Dubs obviously were at the cutting edge of a lot of it, whether amateur or pro, you know.
Yeah, we had two very specific injuries in Dundalk that were sort of unheard of, and we happened to have two, but we had a return to play of around 13 weeks. And I remember Leinster had a very similar injury, and they contacted our medical department to not necessarily follow, they would have went different sports, but they actually want to know what we done. So there's a lot of that going on, and that's what, to be honest, that's what the level of coaching in Ireland is really, really high on an international stage. It is seen as something that's really high, and I think it helps. There's such a cross of between basketball, rugby, GAA, soccer, and the amount of shared information, and it's only a matter of time before coaches realise actually I need to get someone in like this, like Declan, that's really senior, in to give us that extra edge. It's inevitable.
Okay, well, that's all really interesting. We'll probably dedicate a whole programme to it, but we can't, because we have loads to get through. Tony O'Donoghue is standing by to talk to us about Stephen Kenny's Ireland squad that he named a little bit later on. We're going to take a very quick break now, though, and then we'll be straight to Tony. Thanks, Bernard.
Game on 2FM.
Welcome back to Game On with me, Marie Crowe. I'm joined in studio by Vinnie Perth. We are watching the Shamrock Rovers Ghent game, and Shamrock Rovers are trailing 2-0 at half time. We'll get an update from Vinnie on how that first half has gone very, very shortly. But first, we're going to cross over to Tony O'Donoghue to talk about Stephen Kenny's 24-man squad for the upcoming games against Scotland and Armenia. Tony, how are you?
I'm watching that Shamrock Rovers game as well. Having spoken to Stephen Kenny earlier this afternoon about the squad, and we'll talk about Rovers in a minute, but yeah, they're struggling at the moment at halftime, 2-0 down. But as far as Stephen Kenny's squad is concerned, 24-man squad, the headlines, I suppose, the return of Robbie Brady, who was well flagged. He's been playing well for Preston, 18 months since his last involvement with the squad. And he could fix a problem. Perhaps he could play left wing back. He could play further up. He could be the creative force that we've been looking for. Andrew Omabamadeli comes back into the squad as well, as does Callum O'Dowda. But I suppose it's the players who aren't here, as often is the case. The goalkeeper, Creevin Kelleher. That situation between Liverpool and the Republic of Ireland medical staff, if you like, there's something odd going on there, because Jurgen Klopp is convinced, and he said it more than once, that Creevin Kelleher got an injury while on Republic of Ireland duty for the last window when he played in the game against Ukraine. Now, the Irish medical staff will say they have no medical notes that would confirm or suggest that he had no injury. He left camp as fit as when he came in, and that the injury must have happened afterwards. But Creevin Kelleher is not in the Republic of Ireland squad for this international break, which will include games against Scotland and Armenia. But we're told he is back training with Liverpool. So that's a strange one. And then Enda Stevens is out through injury. Adam Ead is missing out through injury as well. And then Daryl Lenihan, who played in that game against Ukraine and was terrific. He doesn't make the 24-man squad. Nor does Will Keane, who's been on the score sheet recently. Nor does CJ Hamilton. I wonder, will we see CJ in a squad again? Will that be a one-cap wonder for a historical footnote? Also, the things that bother me, I guess, thanks for the goodness that Gavin Bazunu and Nathan Collins are doing so well and playing regular first team football in the Premier League, because they're the only two at the moment. Travers has lost his place. Captain Seamus Coleman hasn't had action. Matt Doherty's been on the bench for Tottenham. Shane Duffy's been on the bench for Fulham. So there's a lot of players in this squad who probably need a game or two. So with these two games coming up against Scotland in Glasgow and against Armenia back in Dublin on the following Tuesday, Stephen is more or less accepted, unless Ukraine don't get results in their three games left, the chances of winning the group have gone. He still feels that second place could possibly get you a Euro playoff. And remember, I think it's about 3 weeks now to the draw for the European Championships, and that campaign will all happen in quite a constricted sort of time from next March to next November, and obviously that's the big target now, to qualify for the European Championships in Germany in 2024.
Let's move on to the 21 squad. It was named today as well, and I suppose the buzz after it is the fact that Aaron Connolly has been included in it, Tony.
Yeah, I mean, he's one missing who he would have been and has been a regular starter under Stephen Kenny. And I think Stephen Kenny put an awful lot of faith in Aaron Connolly. But for some reason, it didn't work out for him at Brighton. It didn't work out for him at Middlesbrough. He's in Italy now, in Venezia. He also had a spell at Luton Town, and he needs to find somewhere, something to reignite his career. So by all accounts, he's really anxious to get back in a green shirt, and so he's going to be part of that squad. Also, another player who has had senior experience, that's Udinese's Festi Obisole. Mm-hmm. And Luca Connell of Barnsley comes in as well. Sean Roan of Lincoln City's called up for the first time, as is Aston Villa's Finn Azaz. He's received a first time call up as well. So we've got this situation. I think it's wonderful. I think it's exciting that we've got so much talent coming through, and it's exciting as well that there are players in the senior squad that could perhaps still, the likes of Oma Bamidele, be involved with the 21s, because that's a hugely important game for Jim Crawford and for Irish football to qualify via the playoff against Israel, the two-legged playoff. And it'll be interesting to see if Aaron Connolly does enough to persuade Jim Crawford in training as they lead up to those two legs, if he's done enough to find a place in the squad.
It's a huge game, all right, but it is quite interesting when somebody like Aaron Connolly is attached to a squad like that straight away. It's like, oh, I must get tickets to that. I must, puts it into your consciousness that how big a deal this game is, or how big a player Aaron Connolly is too. Michael Obafemi is another person. It's we seem to be talking about all the things happening off the field today, Tony, but the story with him and Swansea, Stephen Kenny was asked about that too.
Yeah. Michael Obafemi has fallen out, it seems, with his manager, Swansea City boss Russell Martin. He omitted the striker from his squad for the last couple of games, and Obafemi, I think, was hopeful of a move to Burnley, and that fell through on transfer deadline day. So he's saying now that his head isn't right, basically, and he said that it's down to him to put himself back in to show him that he's in the right place to contribute to the group. So again, hardly ideal preparation if a player who has so much potential. I mean, let's remember that goal against Scotland. What a thing of beauty. Mm-hmm. That's something that had us all out of our seats. And we'll be hoping for more from him and from Troy Parrott and, all the exciting potential in the squad. But another one not playing, he needs this international window as well to show to perhaps for the next international window that he's worthy of being a transfer target. He's worthy of being involved somewhere else, or else can he rehabilitate his career with Swansea City?
So overall, Tony, what's your view on the squad? Should we be positive?
I'm worried in the sense of the senior squad at how many players need game time. And you could say Nations League, phony war. I mean, Stephen was adamant at the beginning he wanted to win this. I mean, there's always been doubts about Stephen and his position. I think he, you know, he's got his new contract. He earned that, and the performances did improve. But once again, now you'll need the players to improve. And if players are coming in and they're not tuned up, they're not tuned in, you would worry about that from the seniors' point of view. From the 21s, you know, there's huge potential. When you look at, for example, the likes of Evan Ferguson and his age and how good he is, and Conor Coventry has been superb. Will Smallbone could easily make a senior squad, because I think, you know, in our midfield options in the senior squad, we're threadbare enough, and you know, hopefully these 21s will be getting regular first team football, and we need more Premier League starters if we can and as soon as we can to make this a better squad. If we are to seriously, let's hope the draw is kind to us, but if we're to seriously challenge to make it to the Euros in Germany.
Finny, what are your thoughts on the squad?
Yeah, I think it's quite predictable. Would have been interested if Daryl Lennon had been fit. What would that have meant for someone like Seamus Duffy? That would have been the interesting one for me. Enda Stevens missing. Thought Ryan Manning would have stayed in the squad. But Robbie Brady is listed as a defender. He is playing for Preston as a defender at the moment. So, but I suspect that maybe Matt Doherty will definitely be one of the fullbacks, and maybe stick with Alan Brown in the fullback position or the wing back. Maybe Robbie Brady, James McLean can operate in the left wing back, obviously. So, look, I think it's quite predictable in many ways. Just a point of note, a lot of people in Ireland don't really watch sort of championship football. I was over in the UK a couple of weeks ago. We watched Scott Hogan play for Birmingham. His form, he did get a hat-trick last night, but his form over the last while has been excellent. And he's someone that hasn't always done his best in an Irish jersey, but he's in really good form at the moment. And Stephen tends to pick people on form, so he's one to watch over the next couple of weeks. But to see, does he get a start for Ireland? So, look, in many ways, predictable. I'm glad Will Smallbone stayed with the 21s, and they're going to go after that, which is a huge game. But by and large, the squad is fairly predictable because I would say, of injuries to Daryl Lennon and Enda Stevens. Kevin Keller, I think, hasn't made a Liverpool bench yet, so that'd be interesting. And again, Troy Parrott, albeit he hasn't scored a lot of goals, has been excellent for Preston over the last while. So it's sort of what you expected from the squad.
Okay, Tony, let's
from your point of view, Vinny, I wonder, would you think the likes of Omar Bamadeli could have been given to the under-21s for... I mean, that's a difficult juggling act, isn't
it? Yeah, no, it's a huge debate.
When you think that McGuinness is missing for the first leg?
Yeah, no, it's a huge...
Mark McGuinness?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, I mean, Irish football would get huge benefits if this 21 squad qualified for a major tournament. Look, it's about the long-term and short-term view. Stephen has to do his job and manage his team. But it would make loads of sense for the likes of Omar Bamadele to be dropped into the squad. Thing is, I think Omar Bamadele will start in this Irish team. I think he's ahead of others. I expect the back three to be Omar Bamadele, Nathan Collins.
Collins?
And Egan. Because you've got to... And that's harsh on someone like Darragh O'Shea, but Omar Bamadele's been outstanding on the top of the championship with Norwich, and I think he's probably on form ahead of O'Shea. So look, that's the manager's call. I would like to, you know, someone like Jason Knight, I think he's still eligible, is he, Tony, maybe for the 21s, but no, the manager has to look after himself. And it's unfortunate, because the knock on effect for us getting to a major tournament with Jim Crawford's side would be huge, and we'd see the benefits over the next 4 or 6 years.
Okay. Well, the ideal situation obviously is for the under-21s to qualify, and for Stephen and the Republic of Ireland senior team to get good results against Scotland and Armenia, and that would put you in good stead. The draw is in Frankfurt in, I think, just about 3 weeks' time, so it's going to be absolutely crucial to who we get. And of course, no doubt, we'll have to perform above our seeding again in order to qualify. But that's got to be the ultimate objective.
Well, Tony, in an ideal world, that's how it would work out. In an ideal world as well, Shamrock Rovers would pull a goal back here against Ghent. Can you see it happening?
Oh, I don't know. Just seen a shot from distance there. Sean Kavanagh replaced Chris McCann at half time. I thought McCann was doing quite well in his, I don't know if he's injured or what is the situation there. He's been very good for them. This is a game that has kind of passed Jack Byrne by. I think we've been waiting for him to get back to full fitness mm-hmm. in the hope that he can influence games like this. But look, it was self-inflicted, the two early goals that they conceded. And you know, away from home, it's been a struggle for them. Their home form has been superb. But, you know, at this level, I just don't think you can make mistakes like they have done for the two goals. So they'll be up against it now if they're to do anything in this game.
Okay, Tony O'Donoghue, as always, thank you so much for joining us. We're going to take a very quick break, but stay with us because Jeff Shepherd will be up shortly.
Game on 2FM.
Welcome back. It's time to turn our attention to American sports, and I'm absolutely delighted to say that Jeff Shepherd joins me now on the line. Shep, we're only just getting started with the American football and people are getting very carried away with the Buffalo Bills. So we've had a text in from Joe and Abby Leakes, and he wants to know how they're going to get on.
Well, I mean, they played and looked just like the Super Bowl favorites that they are, Marie. I mean, they absolutely destroyed the Rams, you know, our defending champ, Super Bowl champs right now, 31-10. And the scary part is they turned the ball over three times in the first half. They really only played one half of, you know, good football last week. I believe it was 10-10 at the half. And so Josh Allen was just on fire. His offense is, you know, kind of running in midseason form. And their defense just played incredibly well. Interestingly enough, Von Miller, who was at Denver for so long, left to go to Los Angeles last year for the Super Bowl run. Well, he's now in Buffalo. And so he played really well, too. So, you know, it's the first game, you know, the opening night, that Thursday night. They made a statement, and they kind of separated themselves. And then you looked at what the Kansas City Chiefs also did on Sunday. It seems right away those two teams, you know, you remember that great game we talked about in January when the Chiefs won in the last second in the playoffs. They both just picked up right where they left off. And I think they're clearly the two best teams in the NFL, as much as you want to make a statement like that after the first week.
Yeah, what could possibly go wrong is what springs to mind there. Tom Brady, we talk a lot as well about people being in the headlines for all the wrong reasons. Tom Brady's in the headlines quite a bit, and it's not because of what he's doing on the football pitch. It's for what he's doing off the pitch or for what's not going right for him. But that aside, it doesn't seem to be affecting his game too much.
No. You know, we talked a little bit about this last week with our NFL preview. And as usual, we talked some football and some off the field stuff. And, you know, the thing with Brady is, you know, you've got this situation going on with he and his wife, Giselle. She has clearly made it, you know, stated it that she doesn't want him playing football, and he retired and he's come back and she's not happy. But that didn't distract him at all, or it didn't seem to on the field last week. The Bucs went to Dallas on the Sunday night big marquee game. And really just had no problems whatsoever with the Cowboys. And Dak Prescott, the Cowboys quarterback, broke his hand late in the game. And they'd really only scored 3 points. It was 19-3 was the final. You know, Tampa really didn't have any issues whatsoever. And they don't really have their full complement of offensive players as well. They've got some injured receivers and some different things. But for the meantime, you know, Brady was able to kind of put all of that noise to the side and play a really good football game. They'll be in New Orleans this weekend with a tough division game against the Saints, and so we'll see how he recovers with the, you know, another road game. But as of now, you know, he at least his football life is going swimmingly. His personal life, that still remains to be seen.
And the Seattle Seahawks got revenge on Russell Wilson. His Denver Broncos coming up just short.
Yeah, so this was the Monday night game, Marie, and everybody kind of was, you know, this is a great, you know, ending to the first week of football. And basically the long of it was, you know, Russell Wilson left Seattle after, you know, 10 years or so there and goes to Denver. And it just so happens that that's who they're playing the first week of the season. And he had an okay game. It wasn't great, but it's, you know, it's a tough, loud place to play. But he put him in position with an opportunity to potentially win the game late. And their coach elected to kick a 64, to have his kicker try a 64-yard field goal as opposed to trying to go for it on 4th and 5. And the kick was, you know, was wide to the right. Or to the left, excuse me, and no good. And so Seattle gets a pretty big upset win in week 1 I think most people figured that the Broncos would go on the road and get that win. And so there's a lot of questions going on right now with the Broncos and their coach and you know, the decision that he made to kick that instead of going with Russell Wilson. But it was a lot of drama there. And look, it gets back at it tonight. We've got the Chiefs and the Chargers on Thursday Night Football. And those are two teams that definitely have the playoffs, you know, in their future. And this is a huge game in the AFC West tonight.
Shane isn't here tonight, but he would have been happy, the Jets.
No, I don't understand why he decided he was going to be a Jets fan this year. I mean, you know, congratulations. You know, every team needs their fans. But, yeah, they showed up and they were Jets-tastic one more time. They lost 24-9 to the Ravens, and they're going to start Joe Flacco again this week with Zach Wilson is hurt. So I think the struggles will continue.
Well, Shep, I have a feeling it's going to be a good year this year. We're going to have a lot to talk about, and there's going to be a lot going on, so I'm looking forward to it.
I am as well, and hopefully we can talk more football than off-the-field stuff this year, right?
We don't want to be doing too much of that. We like the drama, too.
I know.
Shep, thank you so much. We will check in with you again next week. Vinny, approaching the hour mark. Are we looking like Shamrock Rovers might get back into it at all?
They've had a couple of chances. Gaffney shot at the keeper, good save from the goalkeeper, and Gary O'Neill has had a shot, but unfortunately for Roberts, you just seem to lack something, need a little bit more pace in the team, because when they won the ball back, it's been too slow, and Ghent have been very comfortable and probably seen the game out now, midweek game for them in the middle of their season, been quite comfortable.
Vinny Perth, thank you so much for coming into studio. Manchester United are still 2-0 against Sheriff, and that man Ronaldo getting the second goal as well. So no doubt he'll be dining out on that for quite some time. Well, that is all we have time for this evening. We'll be back tomorrow, though, previewing all of the weekend sport. Tara Kumar is up next.